For those of you who do not know me, my name is Joachim Hornegger. I'm a professor in the CS department, heading the pattern recognition lab and activities, and one of my major research topics is medical image processing. And this class and the summer semester class is on diagnostic and interventional medical image processing. And what we are going to learn are most recent algorithms that are used in clinical environments to support physicians, technicians in terms of diagnosis and therapy of patients. And today I have planned to give you a brief introduction to the topic. And if we have time, we will start with a brief refresher course on mathematics. In particular, we will talk a little bit about linear algebra. You should be equipped with all the mathematical tools you have learned over 4 semesters in your undergraduate studies. Here is the time to apply all these things. So if you think you are happy having passed the written exam, that's fine for you, but not fine for me. You are required to know all these math in terms of linear algebra, geometry, partial differential equations, and all these things we are going to apply to solve hopefully exciting problems. If you want to get in contact with me, please send me an email. Usually I respond either within an hour or 10 hours or never. So if you do not get an answer within 24 hours, just send me another email with a brief reminder. And if you don't get an email, write a subject like, "You are neglecting your students. What a shame for the university," or something like that. And then I feel really bad and I will answer. Okay? And some of you wrote me an email, "Do we start today?" Some of you said, "Hi, do we start today?" And usually, if you send an email where you are saying hi to me, I answer, "Sehr geehrter Herr," blah, 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 to be very formal, just to make you a little bit aware of what's going on there. And if you write, "Sehr geehrter Professor," I reply, "Hi." So that's the game I play with you. Usually, I'm very easygoing, so don't worry. And the reason why I teach this lecture is not to teach you exciting things. That's a side effect. I usually teach the lecture to have fun. And if you read the comments on my lecture in the web, you always find that I try to integrate students. Yeah. And usually, in the past years, I had a candidate of the day, where I was always asking questions to a selected student. And students were complaining a lot about this, because this basically means that you are lost for the whole lecture if you are the candidate. So I gave up this idea. Yeah, so I will shop around and ask anybody. Preferred, I'll ask people that are late, sir. Okay, good. And if you feel unhappy with being asked questions, just let me know. I have no problems with it if you say, "No, I don't want to talk to you today." You can be sure my brain is not that sharp that I remember these things when you show up in the oral exam. And there is a second comment on the oral exam. If you show up in the oral exam and you have never attended the lecture but watched the videos, that's totally fine with me. The first question will be, "I have never seen you," and then you just tell me, "I was never attending the lecture." I don't care. The important thing at the end of the day is that you can answer the smart questions I ask in the oral exam, or less smart questions. Good. So what's all this about? First of all, a few questions that I'm asked quite frequently. Let me just take the pointer for the video. This is the pointer. Can we shift the time for the lecture? The answer is no. The real answer is yes, we did already. Yeah, we shifted it for a quarter of an hour, but the time on Mondays and Thursdays is fixed, okay? I personally try to teach most of the lectures, but I have to announce that I won't be able on Thursday, and I won't be able the whole next week to teach, so I will send one of my PhD students to give the lecture, and in 2 weeks from now, I'm back to the arena, and I will continue teaching. Is diagnostical medical image processing required? to attend part two, EMIP? That's wrong. Forget this. Do I need to know MATLAB or Octave? You will have to. You will learn MATLAB. We will do all the exercises in MATLAB. Octave is an open source derivative of MATLAB that's providing a similar language, and it's for free. So it's good to know MATLAB for an engineer anyways. Is there a book that covers the topics of the lecture? Since 13 years, I'm saying, no, it's in preparation, and it's still in preparation. So you should give up the idea that there is a book to come. We change everything every year, and it's more or less covered by papers that we give to you and by the slides. So what are the topics? The guidelines for the lecture diagnostic medical image processing, we try to be unique in its contents, and that's also why there is no book. So we look what's going on out there. We have a lot of research projects going on in medical image processing, and we try to find out what's a proper content for our lecture, and we bring in most recent technologies into our lecture. It's a good mixture between basic algorithms that you should know and more recent algorithms that have been developed. At the beginning, we try to show only algorithms that are younger than 5 years, but we cannot keep up with this constraint because a few basic things have to be taught here to ramp you up on a high level. The lecture itself is challenging, but we try to make sure that we are not overloading students. So you will learn a lot. And there is a brief warning. If you attend my lectures, you always have the feeling it's easy. It's easy going and it's easy to understand. But if you sort out things before the oral exam, you will notice that things are sometimes not so easy to understand, and it takes a while. So start early with the preparation of the oral exam. And please, I encourage you to work out the homework problems, because that's really supporting you in understanding the methods. My personal opinion on all this is I usually do not understand algorithms as long as I have not hacked them myself. Yeah? Usually you read algorithms, you have a good intuition, and you think, okay, that's fine, I understand what's going on. But if you sit down and program it, then you start to think, what happens at the border of an image? What happens if I plug in or if I choose the variable 0, 0? What happens? This is a singularity, and then you have to deal with all these special cases. I think there is a special guest to come, huh? I want you to have fun with the lecture. That's important. Yeah, you should really enjoy what we are doing. Hello. We are recorded. Your name?
Solomon.
Solomon.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're welcome. You can sit here. We will also provide access to cutting-edge research. So if you want to write a bachelor thesis or a master thesis project in our lab, it's the best way to prepare for things like that. And we also want to bring students closer to the lab and our research. That means this is a research-oriented lecture. What we also try to do, and this is the general blah blah at the beginning, we want you to introduce to you to our international interdisciplinary and industry collaborators. So it depends how fast we are within the lecture. I will invite physicians from the hospital to give some insight into their daily work and how they use our algorithms for neuroradiology applications, for instance. I will also try to bring you in contact with industry, so a few of you will visiting with me our industry partners, and we also have international guests in the lab, and I will announce lectures and talks of international researchers that you can attend if you want. I want you to learn how to solve hard problems. We all have to be engineers. I'm repeating myself for those of you who attended already lectures that I gave once again. if you think later on in your job you have to solve problems that you can find in the manuscript and in the slides that I provide, this is totally wrong. What you have to learn here is how to solve problems, how to think freshly about things, how to apply the methods you are equipped with to solve problems you have never seen before. Yeah? Otherwise, you will never ever be able to make more than 100,000 euros a month, a year. You have to find the right balance between algorithms, mathematics, physics, and clinical applications. That's also something an engineer has to deal with. I mean, at the end of the day, you have to build something that works. Yeah? And do not overload your algorithms with smart formulas that look very hard. My experience is come up with simple solutions. They usually work and are completely sufficient for applications. Yeah? So at the end of the day, you have to learn as an engineer that there is a common statement. It's good enough at the end for the practitioner. If the doctor tells you, I see what I need to see, that's fine. If there is no mathematical proof that a solution exists, don't care. If you can generate images that are good enough to treat the patient, this is the step into the right direction. Yeah? This is what we engineers have to learn. How to solve problems, how to approximate solutions to problems, and how to deal with solutions that are not brilliant, not excellent, but are working. Yeah? Do not introduce theory and methods, but demonstrate the practical impact. So all the math we do might sound a little hard, but at the end of the day, we will apply it, and you will see that this is important to know to solve practical problems. And we also will guide you to read current research papers. So how do you read a research paper that is written by a researcher recently published? How to get the idea, how to carve out the key contributions, and how to apply these things. That's what we want to learn. What we usually use, and that's some kind of repetition for the medical engineering students in the audience. May I ask how many medical engineering students are here? Oh, welcome again. You like your studies? You like it? I wouldn't say anything different right now. So what we do to generate image information of the human body is usually we apply physics. We apply physics to generate images. For instance, we use standard cameras for endoscopy. We use sound waves for ultrasound imaging. We use X-rays for attenuation images. So we shoot balls or photons through the human body and look how much energy they lose while traveling through the human body. And we generate images out of that. Or we use magnetism in MR imaging to generate images. And medical image processing, the lecture is a perfect combination of physics, mathematics, computer science, and engineering. You have to know everything. What we are not going to learn here are all the details in physics. Yeah? So physics is a black box for us. We just say, okay, we use this effect to generate an image. Once we have captured the image, we do algorithmic design and generate nice looking images. And all the methods we are going to discuss are strongly tied to medical applications and to medicine. So physics is a black box on the one side. On the other side, we also look what type of artifacts we get into the image. For instance, in MR imaging, we will never ever be able to generate a homogeneous magnetic field through the whole patient. We will have distortions, and this type of distortion should be eliminated by signal processing methods. Or if we use X-ray images, we have to fight with artifacts, and we will reduce these artifacts by using algorithms. And we will see terrific examples what we can do to enhance images. And you will also see that the algorithms we design are sometimes very, very important. Good morning. Are very, very important for the final image quality. So you will learn and feel that sometimes three or four lines of code will make up the decision for the doctor to provide us to buy a system or not to buy a system from a certain vendor. Yeah, and we talk about an investment of 1 to 2 million euros, where just three or four lines of code might decide on the decision whether to buy it or not to buy it. So that's interesting. The lectures on diagnostic and medical image processing will focus on algorithmic aspects. We are here in the CS department. We will talk about signal processing applications and signal analysis. And as I mentioned, physics is not part of this course. The following chapters of the winter semester will first of all look at different modalities. I've mentioned already a few. We will see today a few images also that you grow into understanding what type of methods can be used. And then we have three core chapters. And keep these three chapters in mind while attending the lecture. And if you finally have to evaluate the course, there is one question asking, is there a storyline in the lecture? The answer is yes, okay? The answer is yes, because these three lecture or chapters are guiding us through the lecture. We start to talk about image enhancement and pre-processing. How can we improve the images by methods that we learn? We will talk about how we can combine multiple images and reconstruct higher dimensional information out of projections. And at the end, we will talk about image registration and image fusion and what methods are available today to solve this. So, in addition to the lecture, we also offer you an insight to currently ongoing research project at our lab. We will, and that's what I have already mentioned, invite also physicians here to give a few lectures. We will visit maybe the radiology department and the Imaging Science Institute of Erlangen. If you haven't heard about this, we have a special collaboration with industry partners where they provide us the most recent imaging devices for research, and we have access to these machines quite often before they go on the market, and that makes Erlangen also a very special place to study medical imaging. Yeah? The industrial environment we are embedded in is worldwide unique, and you can do things in this field we learn about here in this lecture. You can do things you cannot do at any other place in the world in parallel to your studies, and that's something that makes it even more exciting to learn about medical image processing. Good, that was the general blah blah. Okay, I never ask you anything about this in the oral exam. Yeah, it's just for you to be aware of the environment. And now let's talk about different modalities. Which modalities do you know, Salomon?
Pertaining to what?
Huh? Which imaging modalities do you know? You should use the microphone because it's recorded.
You mean the one you already mentioned, like X-ray, MRI, or?
X-ray, MRI.
CT,
and many, many more. And let's look at a few of them now, and images. So definition, what is a modality? Yeah, scanners used to acquire images of the human body we call modality. So whenever I talk about imaging modality, what do I mean? I just mean what type of scanner is used. And sometimes these scanners are combined. If you go to the molecular imaging department, to the Hospital of Nuclear Medicine, there you will find scanners. They are called SPECT CT scanners or MR PET scanners. These are systems that combine two modalities. That means two cameras are used at the same time to capture an image of the patient. And you have to know each modality. Each acquisition system is using different types of physical effects or effects in physics. And so they visualize different things in the human body. And you can get the best of both worlds by acquiring data by a hybrid scanner where you combine different systems at the same time. The most commonly used modalities are microscopes and endoscopes, because they use CCD sensors, CCD cameras, and capture images like we see it with our eyes. Yeah? They just cover the frequency domain of visible light, and you can visualize, for instance, the inner of the human body. What do we see here? Any guess? That's an endoscopic image. What do we see?
I don't know.
Have you been at the Wiesn?
What?
Have you been at the Wiesn Oktoberfest?
Nope.
Nope. Who has been at the Oktoberfest here? Oh, you're all studying. Mm. I have been twice, actually. I have been twice. This is the liver, and this is the gallbladder. This is the liver. Yeah. This is the liver. So endoscopic surgery, minimally invasive surgeries, for instance, used heavily for removing the gallbladder. Standard surgery where you have three stitches, small stitches here in the belly, no open surgery anymore, and you cut these things. This is also an endoscopic image, and you see also a few artifacts. For instance, you see here some dust, that happens if you burn something, you clean something up, you see dust, and the image quality is not that good, and this is something that we need to correct for. Or here you see specular reflections of this glitchy surface. You have a very strong light source, and then you have specular reflections, and these artifacts somehow should be eliminated from the image. And we have invented very famous sandpaper algorithms, where we take a sandpaper and sandpaper out these artifacts by using the information of the local surrounding of the pixels that are corrupted by this. And we will learn how to do that. Okay? This is another camera that is used to generate images using visible light. What you see here is the retina. You see the retina, the optical disc, the macula, you see the vessels of the support the retina by blood, and this is used for diagnostics in the eye hospital. And it's always surprising for me, and I still cannot believe that in the eye hospital, the most modalities are used to visualize the eye. They have many, many modalities. For instance, here, the medical engineering guys know what we see here. We see here one line of the retina, and we look into it, and we see the different layers of the nerve cells in the retina. And this is generated, this image, by using optical coherence tomography, where we send in light signals and we study the reflected light that comes out of the tissue. And here you see some shadows. Any ideas where these shadows come from? It's from the blood vessels, yeah, where the light is reflected right away. And you have these shadow effects. And we have a lot of research projects ongoing. How can we enhance the optical coherence tomography images in a way that the in vivo imaging, so while the patient is living, is perfect, and that you can derive certain diagnosis out of these images. For instance, if certain layers getting thinner and thinner or disappear, at some point what kind of disease the patient has. So that's a very, very exciting modality and a very recent visualization tool, optical coherence tomography. Other examples are X-rays. What do we see here? What's this? We see a lot of screws, yeah? So that's an X-ray image of, I would say, yeah, and here, this seems to be the leg or something like that, right? And it's fixed. And what do we see here? We see a computed tomography reconstruction out of CT data. The medical image, the medical engineering students know a little bit about this already. We will have an in-depth discussion of reconstruction algorithms in this lecture. So what you see here is the 3D data set, the thorax of a patient, and here you see the axial view through the human body. You see here the lungs, you see here the spine. Here you see the spine, the lungs, and this is a side view. Yeah? So you can visualize things in three dimensions, and how to generate these three-dimensional data sets out of the 2D projections is something that we will talk about. Another modality, magnetic resonance imaging. You see here a slice through the human skull. You see the brain, yeah, and you see different structures, different material. You see the bone. So it's the perfect modality, for instance, in neurology to visualize the human brain. You can also use MRI imaging to visualize brain activities. Yeah, so you show the patient a nice girl, and then you see which part of the brain is being more active, or you show him a nice boy. Where a nice boy, and you see which part of the brain is active, or you show a nice book on medical image processing, and then you see everything is exploding. Yeah, that's a very nice insight. Yeah, good. Ultrasound. So you use sound waves to look into the human body. The advantage of this is that you don't need very expensive equipment. Ultrasound devices are, compared to all the others, rather cheap. So a lot of physicians out there have a low-end ultrasound system for their daily business. And many of you might have already had an ultrasound inspection. Yeah, and this is something that is very nice. The problem is the image quality is very poor. So if you have to do image processing on ultrasound images, then you know that your boss is not appreciating you very much usually. Yeah, that's very challenging, a very demanding technology in terms of image analysis and signal processing, because the images are very noisy. Yeah? For all of you who have already a baby, remember the day when you saw your baby the first time. It was very, very noisy. You just see roughly the contours, and you can derive out of these poor signals a lot of information for diagnosis. So that's totally fine, even if you don't see the precise 3D world as it is using an ultrasound scanner. We will talk a lot about ultrasound or a little more about ultrasound in the summer semester. And here you see one example of a hybrid scanner. So here we use two different scanners simultaneously. On the one hand, you should remember the black and white image here. That's the CT data set we have seen before. And the CT data set is overlaid by one shiny colored image, which shows very strange structures. And this is a molecular imaging picture where we basically inject radioactive material into the blood. The radioactive material is taking part of the metabolism in the human body. And if you have special tracers, special substances with carrying radioactive atoms, you know that these special substances prefer to go to tumor cells, for instance. Yeah? And if you have an accumulation of this radioactivity in a certain part of the human body, and you know that the tracer, the substance you injected, is going towards tumor cells, then you can visualize areas in the human body where you have, with a high probability, tumor cells. Yeah? And with these shiny things, you can show metabolism within the human body, where the radioactive material goes to. For instance, to the liver, where certain substances are processed more, or here into the spine area, and maybe there are some tumor cells. And the doctor just gets, you know, a little blink, and then he looks into the CT data set in more detail and tries to find some shadows or something like that. And then he can analyze the tumor. This can be used to find metastasis. Yeah, so if you have a tumor and the tumor starts to distribute all over the human body, some tumor cells go in the brain, some tumor cells go into the liver or into the lymph nodes. You want to know where are all the tumor cells. And then you inject things like that, and then you see these shiny parts, and you can support the search for tumor cells in the human body a lot by using these images. They do not provide a lot of anatomical information. They just show shiny dots and shiny areas. But if you have a hybrid scanner, you can combine it with a CT data set, and then you can see, here is the bone XYZ, and there is this little shiny thing. I go in there and take some cells out for analyzing them under the microscope, for instance. Yeah? Here is a typical hybrid scanner, as these systems look like today. This one is a SPECT CT scanner. So you see basically here two gamma cameras. These are, in German, Geigerzähler. They do nothing else but just count the radioactivities, the radioactivity, or measure the radioactivity. And in the back, you have this donut structure. That's a CT scanner where you capture X-ray images and you reconstruct three-dimensional information on the patient. Yeah, and hybrid scanners are used quite often. Here, SPECT CT, that's this one. PET CT, that's another molecular imaging device, very similar to SPECT. Few differences, but very similar. PET MR, that's the most recent technology. There are not that many out there. They cost about 5 million euros. We have one here in Erlangen at the Institute of Medical Physics for experimentation. Or also in endoscopy, you combine 2D color images with 3D surface images, for instance, to visualize the inner human body. So there are many, many combinations you can think of. What we are currently working on is how to combine ultrasound with X-ray images, yeah, during an intervention. That's also very exciting. And the question is, how can you bring all these images together and make sure that the image information sits in a joint coordinate system with the same origin, with the same orientation and everything? Yeah, the doctors don't want to see the images side by side and look left and right and left and right and build together the structure of the molecular image and the CT image. They want to see it right away sitting above each other, and then they want to use the slider to fade between the different worlds. Yeah? That's what we have in mind in terms of application. And if we talk about hybrid scanners, you always have to ask the question, what do I see more in modality A than in modality B and vice versa? And there are two different big classes of modalities that we can distinguish. First, morphologic imaging. Morphologic imaging just means we visualize the anatomy. Yeah? If we want to visualize the anatomy of the human body, we apply morphologic imaging or anatomic imaging. We show the structure of the human body. And what are typical modalities to do that? Endoscopes, X-ray imaging, computed tomography, magnetic resonance imaging, ultrasound, they all show different tissue classes, that their spatial distribution, and they explain how the human body is built up in terms of materials. Yeah? Soft tissue structures and things like that. For instance, here in CT, you can see easily the bones. If you choose a proper visualization tool, you can visualize the muscles, you can visualize the vessels. You visualize basically the structure of the human body. And that's the definition. Don't learn these things. You will get used to it anyways. Yeah? Don't sit at home today and learn these things. You will get used to these soft facts easily. Yeah? Morphologic imaging is about the imaging of the physical appearance of the inner human body, like shape, structure, or density. I'll not ask this type of definitions. And what are the challenges in morphologic imaging? I mean, you might say, Wilhelm Conrad Röntgen, yeah, 1895. He made the first X-ray image, the hand of his wife. It was a brilliant image. That's fine, I'm happy with it. We go for it forever. Yeah? But research is still looking into these things. What can we improve? And what we want to improve, for instance, is to increase spatial resolution. So we want to see tiny little structures, tiny little structures in visualizing the inner human body. And what we have in mind is long-term vision that we can use from external scanners into the human body down to the DNA structure. Yeah? That's what we have in mind. Today we can't do that. We can look at bones and we can look at soft tissue and we can look at fat and everything. But the spatial resolution with X-ray, for instance, is limited to what type of tiny little structures can we visualize with X-rays? Just a guess. It depends on the scanner. If you buy a Siemens scanner, you might have a higher spatial resolution. At least as an Erlangen guy, you can say things like that. What's your name?
Tobias.
A guess. Come on.
It's something about millimeter.
Millimeter range. So 1 millimeter? If you think about, you know, having a neuroradiologist doing something in the brain, and the little vessel that supports your eye with blood has a diameter less than 0.5 millimeter. Do you think it's important to see things like that if you cut through it?
Yes, it is. But
it is, yeah. So,
you have to prepare because it depends on how great the length you want to X-ray through. So, if you have small samples, then you can visualize smaller.
Right, you can go into the micromillimeter range if you use it for animal image, like small mouses, yeah, where you cook the mouse basically while imaging. In scanners that are used in hospitals, you get down to 0.1 millimeter and a little below even today. So you can visualize structures of 0.1 millimeter and below. That's fantastic. In CT, you are at 0.3 millimeter in terms of isotropic resolutions in the three directions, and in MR imaging you are down to 2 millimeters. Yeah, that's the range we are in. And in SPECT imaging, what do you guess? If we visualize metabolism, what do you think is the spatial resolution? No idea? A guess.
A little higher than this, or a little lower than this?
No, higher. Unfortunately, higher. Way higher. You are up to 5 millimeters. 5 millimeters, that's a lot, yeah? So you see there is something we need to improve. What else do we need to do? We need to minimize the artifacts caused by respiratory motion. For instance, you capture an image and the patient is breathing. Yeah, that's always the trade-off we have to deal with. Yeah? If the patient is not breathing, we can generate brilliant images, but nobody needs it anymore. And if the patient is breathing, we get poor image quality because you have motion artifacts. And the question is, how can you, for instance, compensate for these motion artifacts? And we need new algorithms for the reconstruction of moving objects in CT. So the heart is beating, yeah, and we want to do a 3D reconstruction or even 4D reconstruction of the beating heart. That's something we look into it. We look into and where we come up with cool algorithms. To summarize, morphological imaging is still a highly demanding, innovative, and challenging research field. And we have hundreds of different projects ongoing worldwide that try to improve morphological imaging by using image processing algorithms. So that's a very emerging field still. And in our lab, we have a lot of ongoing research projects, in particular in this field, where we try to deal with motion. And the problem is that the motion is unknown. Yeah, we don't know how the heart beats. We have maybe the ECG signal that tells you something on the state of the heart, but we don't know the motion vector field, how the heart moves or how breathing goes. And we have to estimate these different types of motion and then compensate for it. And that's very challenging using just image-driven approaches to solve for this type of problem. The second class, besides morphological imaging, is molecular imaging. Yeah? In the early days, this was called functional imaging. So these are the different terms you will find: morphologic imaging or anatomic imaging versus, and here we have functional imaging. This term is no longer that modern. It sounds more technical. We visualize the function of the human body, not the morphology, not the structure, but the way how the body works, how the metabolism, Stoffwechsel, how the metabolism works. You want to visualize things, how the brain works, how the brain reacts on certain stimuli from outside. And the more modern term is molecular imaging, because we use the molecular level and molecular changes to visualize the functioning of the human body. Yeah? And again, I have a nice definition for you that you should not learn. You will know these things by heart later on. So molecular imaging is about the imaging and visualization of processes and changes in the organism on the molecular level. Yeah? So we look what's happening in the inner part. For instance, in PET, positron emission tomography, we have again the trick that we have radioactive material, and the radioactive atoms are linked to, for instance, glucose molecules. The glucose is participating in metabolism and then sending out signals that we can measure from outside. So we know where the glucose molecules that are radioactive go to, and we can measure where they accumulate. Yeah, single photon emission tomography is a similar technique. And magnetic resonance imaging, that's some kind of hybrid in terms of functional and morphological imaging. You can use magnetic resonance imaging also for functional imaging. Yeah? You have special protocols, and magnetic resonance imaging has a lot of degrees of freedoms, and you can also use them to visualize how things are doing within the human body. Yeah? You can visualize blood flow, for instance. Yeah? So, and the abbreviation is fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, if you see that later on. What are the challenges and the potential? What is the potential of molecular imaging? Well, molecular imaging relies a lot on the tracers. Advances in molecular medicine. So we have people in chemistry that work in the medical school at our university. They are designing every day new tracers, new molecules that participate in the metabolism, that hook up to certain tumor cells, and they try to build in some radioactive atoms such that the human body doesn't notice that the molecule was changed, and you can measure from outside different things in the human body. So the design of tracers, as we call this, is something that is very important. We have one hospital here at our medical school. It's the Hospital of Nuclear Medicine, where this is exactly done. We have people in chemistry, computer scientists, people in engineering. They all work together to visualize the metabolism and to use new tracers, new detectors, new technology to visualize the way the human body works. And what we want to show is we want to visualize processes on a cellular and molecular level in the human body. Yeah? And it's also expected that this will be the connecting link between radiology. Radiology is well established. Yeah? If you go to the radiology department, there are different scanners. You go in there, you get a scan and get nice images, and many things are clear after the scan. In molecular medicine, a lot of research is ongoing, and the question is, how can we link these two fields together? And functional imaging is part of the story here. So I'm sorry, I'm walking up and down, so you are really challenged in the back with the camera. So he always complains that I'm moving a lot and that makes students nervous, but that's the way, you know. I have to keep the blood flow up. So molecular imaging is considered as the initialization of the next revolution in medical imaging. So it's expected to come something real new, and you can be part of it if you work in this. And things that happen currently in research and industry actually show that there is the highest type, highest degree of innovation ongoing compared to all the other modalities that we are studying. Okay, so we talked about morphologic and molecular imaging, anatomy versus functioning, metabolism. Okay, that's what we keep in mind. And now we talk about diagnostic and interventional imaging, because this lecture is on diagnostic medical image processing. The summer semester is on interventional medical image processing. And the obvious question is, what is the difference? Do you have a feeling what is the difference? No. Salomon, do you have a feeling? No?
In vivo and in vitro?
No. 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 Tobias?
Yes, I have an idea, because some diagnostic returns want to visualize the patient. So, for example, we make a CT of a live patient, and on interventional, we have additional challenges. Because maybe we want to do some surgery, and now we want to have X-ray, and that's quite complicated because we have...
That's basically the answer. Very hard to remember. I give you a simple example you will remember forever. In diagnostic medical image processing, usually the images are captured by a technician, yeah? Not by the doctor himself. A technician captures the images, uploads these images to some viewing workstation, is preparing the images for the doctor, doing some image enhancement, and then the doctor or the radiologist looks at it and does a diagnosis. So if the system crashes, usually the technician is not very happy, but the doctor doesn't notice this quite often. Yeah? So for an engineer, it's not that critical to build diagnostic systems. Yeah? If they die, usually a technician calls and he tries to be nice and you can explain to him and then you can fix these things and nothing happens to the patient, nothing serious. In interventional imaging, the doctor is capturing the images himself. He has gloves and bloody fingers, and he needs the image information to proceed with the surgery he's currently doing or the intervention. So interventional image processing is way more demanding in terms of reliability, in terms of efficiency, in terms of image quality, and so on and so on, because the doctor uses the image information to guide through the procedure. So if an X-ray system dies while the doctor is fixing your coronary arteries, yeah, you can be sure that the doctor himself will call the company and you will run into serious problems. And you have to make sure that this will never ever happen, because the patient can die if the system is not up and running and providing the image information that is required to run a safe procedure. Yeah, so these are the different aspects, and in winter semester we will talk about diagnostics. Yeah, so we have all the time in the world to generate images. We can talk about how to increase the beauty of images and get the most out of the images in terms of diagnosis. And in summer semester we will go into the bloody business. Yeah, we will go into the bloody business and talk about what type of methods, algorithms are required to support the procedure of the doctor. So reliability is an issue, but also workflow optimization, to embed the methods we provide in a way into the clinical workflow that the doctor gets smoothly through his therapeutic procedure and is fast and safe with the patient. So diagnostic, two definitions, the process of analyzing a disease by its symptoms and from the results of various measurements and images is called diagnosis, blah, blah, blah. Okay? Diagnosis means you look at the image and some measurements and then you derive using your knowledge about medicine what's going on with the patient. Diagnostic imaging includes the visualization of morphological structures and molecular processes of organs or tissues for the particular diagnostic evaluation. Yeah? So you capture different images if needed, and then you look at the images and then you think about it. Yeah? That's also the point where, for instance, big data mining techniques also come in. You have an image. Where are you from?
From Nuremberg.
Nuremberg. Where are you from?
Langenzenn.
Do you have a hospital?
Yes.
Yes, they have a small hospital. Yeah, Langenzenn. And the doctor captures an X-ray image and has never seen what he's seeing. Yeah? For instance, if you have a smart search engine that looks for similar cases in the web and comes up with a diagnosis in other cases, he can look at this and rate his current case and decide what's going on there without having too much medical information. Yeah? So diagnosis is also diagnostic imaging, and diagnosis is also very demanding in terms of very recent computer science research topics. In diagnostic imaging, what do we do? Usually, image acquisition is done by a technician and not by the treating physician. That's something that brings you as an engineer on the safe side. The system parameters can be adjusted without high time pressure. So you can adjust your parameters and acquisition protocol in a way that you get the best images of the current patient. You have usually you have way more time than during an hectic surgery for a stroke patient, for instance, yeah, where each minute counts for the patient. We have, of course, the requirement of short acquisition times, but it's not crucial. I mean, if you can capture images of 200 patients a day, you can make more money than with a system where you can only make 100 patients a day. That's for sure. Yeah, but it's not that critical like in procedures where you have a stroke patient where each minute is important to save brain cells, for instance. Yeah? So time is important but not crucial, and a system crash is quite often not life-threatening. Yeah? So if the system dies, it should not die, but if it dies, it's not life-threatening. It's different in interventional imaging. Just remember the bloody fingers. Yeah? That's all you need to remember. Then you can derive all the other things from that. In medical intervention, we apply methods to modify a health outcome. And interventional imaging provides real-time image guidance to the physician to allow for an effective treatment. So it's a tool. Yeah? Like the knife for the surgeon, the imaging device is a tool during the therapeutic procedure. In interventional imaging, image acquisition is done while the patient gets treated. So that's very important. The image acquisition is usually done by the physician. So if he does not like the user interface, that's a serious problem. If the technician is not very much appreciating the user interface, you can always discuss. Yeah? So the doctor should be happy with the user interface. It should be very easy to use. And he should not adjust 500 parameters before he can visualize the coronary arteries or the cerebral vessel system. Now that should be easily, that should be possible in a very easy manner. The focus is on the patient, not on the system. So the doctor don't want to think about what is the system doing now and how to use the system. The system is a tool and should be used right away within the procedure, and the core of all the decisions and all the procedure is the patient. So the focus is on the patient, not on the system. This is just something that is a side and should be easy to use. We have high demands on reliability. Real-time image acquisition is an issue. I mean, you cannot have your stroke patient on the table and then do a 3D reconstruction and tell the user, now you have to wait 30 minutes for the 3D reconstruction. It has to be reconstructed within less than 30 seconds. And usually we are also, as an engineer, required to make use of proprietary hardware. Yeah? This is the place where special hardware is still built and algorithms are optimized with respect to a particular and specific hardware environment. So what are the take homes for today? You did the right decision to attend this lecture. I'm very serious, yeah? I hope I won't lose you. That's an excellent choice. It's an interdisciplinary lecture where you can apply all the wonderful things you have learned so far at your university career. You will learn a lot for your future. Many of you might end up in... Oh, that's the worst message you can give to me. Will you be back on Thursday?
Maybe, but I have my introduction lesson now.
It's fine. Take care. I would never have dared to stand up at this point of the lecture, but he did. So you will learn a lot. A lot of you might end up in this field. We have a lot of industry contacts. The excellent students are usually grabbed by industry right away, and a lot of our students are working now for our industry partners. I'm sure you will have tons of fun. At least I will have tons of fun. You will learn about the concept of different, or you learned about today, about different image modalities, very superficial, but it's sufficient for our understanding so far. We talked about hybrid scanners, the best of different worlds we want to combine. And we have seen that there are different types of medical imaging directions, morphologic versus molecular imaging, diagnostic versus interventional imaging. Anatomy, functioning, technician, bloody fingers. Yeah? That's the association you should have built up in your brain. Good. We also put a few references on the slides already. So if you want to read more about these things that I have mentioned today, you can have a look into a few books. For instance, the second one written or edited by Arnulf Oppelt. It's on imaging systems for medical diagnostics, fundamentals, technical solutions, and applications for systems applying ionizing radiation. That's a very readable book, very worth having a look into it. And did you photograph me or the slide? Me, thank you. You can download all the slides on the web. They are public and they are not protected by passwords. And many of the images I borrowed from the internet are also supported by a link where you can find the original source. So I'm very easygoing with these things. So that's a book that was written by Siemens engineers. Yeah? And it's very, very up to date in terms of technology. And it's a book that supports a lot, many topics that we are discussing here. And if you want to dig a little more into the mathematics we are going to use, there is a nice book on the mathematics of medical imaging that covers most of the mathematics that we are going to use here. And one of the most important mathematical tools that we are going to use is is the singular value decomposition. And that's what I'm going to talk about now. Also, the introductory session. There will be no exam on the introductory session. And now it's SVD time. There is the rumor. If you show up in the oral exam and you have no answer to the current question, if you answer SVD, it's usually the big point.
I already did SVD.
You did SVD?
Yes.
Okay. Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure.
Bye. So singular value decomposition. I mean, the nice thing on this tool is that you can use it to solve any linear algebra problem. Most of it. Yeah? So if you have a linear algebra problem, you can apply SVD and then you are done. Who has never ever heard about singular value decomposition in the audience? Hui. What are you studying?
Medical engineering.
Medical engineering? Where did you learn about SVD?
Medical engineering in Biden.
Which lecture?
I didn't learn about it in any lecture, but I was required to tutor it in mathematics tutor.
Okay. Where did you learn it?
I have taken the course of linear algebra, but just a course.
Okay. Where?
Math and other class.
IMIP. You attended already IMIP. Okay, good, good. Did Andy Meyer show these slides also? Okay, the same. Okay. Should we do the refresher course, or are you all feeling comfortable with the knowledge you have? I should. Okay. I'll quickly browse through it. Okay. So singular value decomposition is basically nothing else than a normal form of a matrix. So we can transform all matrices, whether they are regular or singular, whether they are quadratic or rectangular, blah, blah, blah. You can transform them into a normal representation. And this is a product of an orthogonal matrix with a diagonal matrix with an orthogonal matrix. Yeah? And the question is, what can we do with it at the end of the day? The method is well known in numerical algebra. It was invented in the 19th century. Then people forgot about this for a long time. And it was rediscovered by Gene Golub, computer science professor at Stanford. He made it very public. And in our community, at the beginning of the 90s, Carlo Tomasi came up with a very nice algorithm that makes use of singular value decomposition for structure from motion algorithm. So you capture an image sequence and you want to compute out of the image the camera motion and the 3D structure. You can do this by using singular value decomposition. It's extremely robust and it's very simple to use. And as I mentioned, you can apply to mostly any problem in linear algebra. So SVD is a perfect tool to compute the null space of a matrix. What is the null space of the matrix? What is the null space or the kernel? Null space. It's good that we go into the refresher course, I think. What's the null space? The null space is the set of all x that are mapped to 0. Yeah, that's the null space. We call it null space of A, or in many books, it's also the kernel of the matrix A. That's the set of vectors that maps to the zero vector. Yeah? All matrices have a trivial null space. So the zero vector is always in the null space. But there are matrices that have a non-trivial null space. Yeah, some vector that is mapped to a zero. If a matrix, quadratic matrix, has a non-trivial null space, this is a clear indicator that the matrix cannot be inverted. It has a rank deficiency. You can compute the rank of a matrix. What is the rank of a matrix? What is the rank of a matrix? A long time ago, I talked to one of my colleagues and I told him my students do not know what a rank is. And he was saying, my students are a little better. They said the rank of a matrix is n. But that's not what I wanted to hear. What's the intuition of a rank, of the rank?
Of the column space.
That's the dimension of the column space. If you look at a matrix, you can rewrite a matrix A. Let's say A11. A12, A21, A22. The indices in German is easy to remember. Zeilen zuerst, yeah. First the line index, second the row index, the column index. And you can also write this in terms of column vectors, yeah, in terms of column vectors. And the rank tells you what is the dimension of the space that is spanned by the column vectors. If the column vectors are linearly independent, that means you cannot rewrite one column by a linear combination of the other columns. If the column vectors are linearly independent, the matrix has full rank. Yeah? The rank tells you the rank tells you the number of linearly independent column vectors. And if a matrix has a non-trivial null space, it also has a rank deficiency, by the way. Yeah, so the rank and the null space and the dimension of the null space, they correlate to each other. So read about this. You should have learned this in the first semester, yeah, right after Christmas. You can use the SVD to compute the inverse of a matrix. And the nice thing is, if the matrix cannot be inverted, we find an inverse, we call it pseudo-inverse, that is as close as possible to the potential inverse of the matrix. So the message is, if you have to compute the inverse of a matrix and you know SVD, you don't care about the rank and whether the matrix can be inverted and whether the matrix has full rank and blah, 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 you just compute the pseudo-inverse. And if the matrix can be inverted, the pseudo-inverse is the inverse. And if the matrix cannot be inverted, the pseudo-inverse is as close as you can get to an inverse of a matrix where no inverse exists. And the question is, what does it mean as close as possible? We will learn about this. But the conclusion is, forget about checking whether a matrix can be inverted or not. Use SVD and compute the pseudo-inverse. That's the closest you can get to an inverse of a matrix. Huh? I will explain this in more detail during the lecture. We can compute the solution of overdetermined linear equations, so you have more equations than unknowns. How to deal with that? Even with inconsistent systems of equations where no solution exists, we can find a solution by using SVD. Also, this is something that we will talk about. We can compute condition numbers. What is a condition number? A condition number tells you something about the sensitivity of the matrix. So what happens if you change the input vector? So the x in AX, if you have something like this, y is AX. If you change the x a little bit, how much does it affect the y vector? A well-conditioned matrix has the property, if you change the input variable a little bit, the output will vary a little bit. An ill-conditioned matrix will have the property, if you change here a little bit, this will jump like crazy. Yeah? And this is also important for us, for the numerical analysis. Yeah? If we have noisy measurements, how much does it affect the output if we compute the output by a linear transform defined by a matrix mapping? Yeah? Small variations in the input, high variations in the output. Would you like to have an imaging system like that? No, you wouldn't. Huh? So we can compute something like a condition number, and we can also enforce a rank criterion. That's also interesting. By theory, we will find algorithms and methods where we know that a matrix that we build has a certain rank. And we can enforce this rank by using SVD. So usually if we have measurements, the matrix will have the rank that is identical to the number of column vectors if we have a quadratic matrix. If we know there is a rank deficiency, we can enforce this rank deficiency by using the SVD. And how this can be done, we will also learn. Yeah? So there are many things that you see here where you have the feeling, oh my God, yes, there was something I remember. Yeah? And you don't remember how to compute these things. And now you can sit back and say, He is explaining to me SVD, and I can solve all these problems where I have no clue about how we solved it in the first and second year of my university career. Okay? So, and believe me, you will be able to solve all these things by heart at the end of the semester if you attend the lectures or if you watch the videos. Yeah? We will use it over and over again. And I'm sure you sit at home in the evening and you say, I can't hear it anymore, SVD. Yeah? And if I ask you something, how do we solve it in terms of numerical mathematics, SVD is a proper choice and always worth a thought. First, before we define matrices and the SVD, decomposition of matrices, let's look at the geometry of matrices. So if I give to you a matrix, what do you have in mind while looking at this? I mean, maybe you switch to the panic mode and you say, whoa, matrix, I don't know what to do with it. On the other hand, a matrix is a very nice, beautiful, wonderful structure and a very nice, beautiful construction. And we can analyze a matrix geometrically. And let me give you an intuition on this a little bit. I'll switch on the light because I want to write something on the blackboard. I still wish to get back the good old days where I just had a switch to switch on the light. And the light switched on, and now I have, okay. These complicated things. So let's look at a matrix A. Let's start with a 2x2 matrix. Yeah, that's usually we use 3x3 matrices to think about it. Let's start with a 2x2 matrix. It tells us everything. 1, 1, 1, 2, 2, 1, 2, 2. Yeah. And the A, I, J's, let all these be real, real values. So if I plug in a vector X, let's say AX, this is A times X1, X2. And what is it? I end up with a 2D vector that's A11. X1 plus A12 X2, A21 X1 plus A22 X2. So far you say, okay, that's easy. I remember that. So that's easy. We still remember that, okay? If you look at that, let's look at the first line. What is this? The first line is the, did I do a mistake? No. Okay. The first line, what is it? This is the inner product of this vector with the x vector. The inner product. What is the inner product telling us? It's the cosine between the two vectors. So this is nothing else but a projection. In terms of geometry, we project the x vector on the row vector of the matrix. So this can be rewritten. A can be rewritten in terms of a transposed, where these are the row vectors, the row vectors times x, and this is A transposed 1x, A transposed 2 times x. Okay? So what the matrix does is it projects the input vector on the row vectors up to a scaling. Yeah? That's cool. We will use it. Yeah? We do an inner product of the x vector on the row vectors. Okay. We can also read the matrix differently and say A is A1, A2, and these are the column vectors. Yeah? And if I now do the following, A times X, I can rewrite this as A1, A2 times X. And this is A1, A2 times X1, X2. And what I do now is I multiply the first row with X1 plus I multiply the second row with X2, and I have a linear combination of the column vectors. Yeah? So I do, if you have the feeling this is simple, I know all this, that's perfect. Yeah? I know that this is some kind of redundancy for you. That's X1 times A plus X2 times A2. So multiplication of a matrix with a vector is nothing else but a linear combination of the column vectors, where the input vector components define the weights of the linear combination. Yeah? So we take the first column vector, scale it by x1, plus second column vector, scale it by x2, and plug it together, and we get a resulting vector. Okay? So we have two geometric interpretations. One is the inner product. We compute the inner product of the rows with the input vector, so that's a projection. Think about that. And the second one is the linear combination of the column vectors. Okay? It's also cool. And now the question is, what can we do with it? What can we do with things like that? We can do a lot. Let's look at an example. Let me just wipe the board. If you need to leave today because you have other plans, feel free to do so. Yeah? Solomon will just note the names of the students that are leaving early, and we will come back to you soon. Good. Think about the following. We are now equipped with a nice geometric understanding of matrices. Think about the following problem. I write a piece of code for you. Yeah? The input is a vector, and the output is also a vector. And I tell you what I do is a linear mapping in it. And you want to compute the matrix that performs this linear mapping by using my module that I compiled. You get a library, you cannot look into the original code. You just have a way to plug in any vector you want to have, and you observe what's produced by the module, and then you have to produce the matrix. Would you consider this to be a hard problem?
No.
Just say yes. Think about the didactical structure of my lecture. It appears very hard to you, right? But it's not, actually. It's not. I told you I want to have fun here, so you just have to play with me. Yeah? It's not a hard problem. Why? Let's look at the following. So we have a matrix. We call it H. Yeah? We call it Honegger module, H. So we can do this and compute the Y. Okay. And of course, you know about the dimension because the interface that I give to you tells you the dimension of the input vector is, let's say, 3. Yeah? So this is 3. And this is also meant to be 3. This is also meant to be 3. Okay? And you can put in any vector x, and you generate an output y, and you have to compute h. How can you compute H? Well, you know that H, if it's a mapping from 3D to 3D, you know that H is a 3x3 matrix. It's a 3x3 matrix, right? Of course. And you can write H to be H1, H2, H3, where Hi is the 3D column vector. Okay? Good. And what you now do is a very simple thing. You say Hx is x1 times h1 plus x2 h2 plus x3 h3. Now, and if you want to know what is the first column of the matrix, you just put in 1, 0, 0. Yeah? You just compute this. So you get the first column. Yeah? Then you compute h 0, 1, 0, and you get h2. And you compute 0, 0, 1, and you have h3, and you have the matrix. In signal theory, systems and signals, you have tons of proofs where you show that a Dirac impulse of a linear system gives you the convolution kernel that is expressed in terms of the linear system. This is what it does, actually. It's nothing else. Yeah? For those of you who have learned this, the others just ignore it. The message is, and that's a lemma that you have to remember, if I want to have the column vectors of a matrix, I just have to plug in the base vectors of my base coordinate systems, and my columns of the matrix drop out. Yeah? Let's look at a cool application of this. Let's compute a 2D rotation matrix. So what we want to do is, we want to compute a 2D rotation matrix. The medical engineering students have seen this already in my first semester lecture, I guess. But anyways, I like it very much, and it's important because we will use this type of technique heavily within the lecture. So let's briefly look at that. It's also on the slide, so you don't have to copy it from the blackboard, but I slow down the explanations usually if I show it on the blackboard. So what we want to do is compute R that defines 2D rotations. The simple idea we have discussed tells us we just have to look what happens to the base vectors by rotation. Yeah? And this tells us what the column vectors are. Do you remember how the rotation matrix looks like? Yeah, something with sinus phi, cosine phi, and somewhere here is a minus, and we don't know what, yeah? And that's also my problem. I don't remember where is the minus and what happens. So very easy to derive. You look at the following situation. You have your x1 and xy or x2 axis. You have your base vector. This is the vector 1, 0. This is the vector 0, 1. And now you rotate the whole thing. So you have the unit circle. You rotate the whole thing by phi. And you just have to see what is the vector the base vector ends up with. So 1, 0 is mapped to, well, it's mapped to cosine phi, sine phi, and the vector 0, 1 is mapped to minus sine phi, cosine phi. Minus, so the matrix is nothing else but cosine phi, sine phi, minus sine phi, cosine phi. Period. Done. You can also think now, think about how three-dimensional rotations are represented by linear mappings by using exactly the same idea. Okay? Wow. Well, that is cool, right? That's cool. Don't copy these things. Good. I have all this here on the slide. So you can look at column vectors that represent the matrix. Yeah? If the number of rows is smaller or equal to the number of columns, we have full rank if the vectors are linearly independent. And you plug in a vector into the matrix, and if you have the 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, you just have a projection or a selection process of the row, of the column of the matrix, sorry. Yeah? That's what we got. That's exactly the idea you had in mind, right? Mm. But you remember from Andrea's lecture, or? Okay. This is the example we just did at the blackboard. You can study this, yeah, how to compute the rotation matrix. And another important aspect is, if we talk about the geometry of matrices, is the question, what happens to unit vectors? If we try to understand what a matrix is doing, we also look what happens to unit vectors. If you look in 2D, I still have too much energy. If you look in 2D, if you look into 2D, you know the unit vectors. They sit on the circle with radius 1, right? So x1, x2. So these are all the unit vectors you can think of. And the question is, what happens to these unit vectors while applying the matrix? Yeah? And you can write MATLAB code where you take multiple unit vectors, you plug it in, and you look where you end up in the image space of the matrix. And you will end up with an ellipsis in many cases. Yeah? And if you end up again with a circle in the same dimension, you know that's an orthogonal transformation. So the matrix has the nice property that the inverse is its transpose, for instance. So what you should really start to do, and that's what I'm used to now, when I have to deal with a new matrix, yeah, I usually look what happens to the unit ball, and I look at the geometry, and then I know how much things are stretched or what happens actually. Then you get a good understanding for the geometry of the matrix. Study the geometry of the linear mapping while looking at the unit vectors and the images of the unit vectors generated by one. And this is exactly also what the SVD studies. It studies how much the axes of this ellipsis are stretched or not stretched. SVD is doing nothing else but studying the deformation of the unit ball that is implied by the matrix mapping. And if you have a rank deficiency, then you also see that you lose a dimension of the unit ball. If you have a three-dimensional sphere, and you have a rank deficiency, you end up with a circle, for instance, instead of having a sphere, things like that. So it's always worth to look into the geometry of the matrix. And now let's define singular value decomposition that most of you have seen already, but let's do it again. So for any real M times N matrix, we find a decomposition in U sigma V transposed, where U is an orthogonal M by M matrix. Sigma is a diagonal matrix with positive entries with a decreasing size. And V is also a N by N matrix that is also orthogonal. So if a matrix is orthogonal, what happens to the unit ball? It remains a unit ball. Yeah? If you plug in a vector that sits on the unit ball, you end up with another vector that sits on the unit ball. Yeah? The inverse is the transpose. It's also nice. So the inverse of U is U transpose. The inverse of V is V transpose. Very interesting. If we have here a matrix where all the singular values are 1 and m is equal to n, and you have to compute the inverse, you just transpose the matrix because you have a product of two orthogonal matrices, which ends up to be again an orthogonal matrix. Yeah. So what we want to do with the SVD is we compute the decomposition of a matrix A in U sigma V transpose. And it's very hard to compute SVD. In MATLAB, it's just SVD of A. Yeah? It gives you the singular value decomposition, and then you can do anything with it. And the diagonal matrix carries here the singular value. Singular values, they are all non-negative, and they are ordered in a decreasing manner. So if you read the diagonal elements, they get smaller and smaller and smaller. And once you have this decomposition, you can look at the singular values, and you can, for instance, say, what is the rank of the matrix? The rank of the matrix is just the number of non-zero singular values, for instance. Or you can compute the condition number of a matrix, which is the ratio of the largest singular value and the smallest singular value, and things like that. We will go through all the examples in the following. But this will be done on Thursday by Andreas Meyer or somebody else from my lab. Thank you very much, and see you 2 weeks from now again. But the lecture will continue, and I will send a surrogate. Thank you, and enjoy.